This is Scott Becker with a special edition of the Becker's Healthcare Podcast. Thrilled today to be joined by Dr. Josh Sharfstein. Josh is at Johns Hopkins, one of the premier institutions in the country and a place that everybody's following related to the coronavirus. He also served as the chief of population health for the state of Maryland at one point. I might have the title not exactly right, but Josh will tell me. Josh, can you take a moment, Dr. Sharfstein, and introduce yourself? And then I'll ask you a couple questions about what you see and where this is going.
Sure. Thanks for having me. I am a pediatrician, and in my past, I worked as a city health commissioner in Baltimore, as the state health secretary of Maryland, as the principal deputy commissioner at the Food and Drug Administration, and now I'm professor of the practice in health policy and management at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, where I teach a class called Crisis and Response in Public Health Policy and Practice. And I wrote a book called The Public Health Crisis Survival Guide, Leadership and Management in Trying Times. In my class, we talk about management of crises.
So this seems to be exactly the time that your book talks about, public health crises. Tell us a little bit about what your senses of how the government should be responding versus how they're responding and sort of where you see this going.
So this is a crisis that exceeds every crisis I wrote about in my book. I did not write about the 1918 Great Influenza. I wrote about a whole bunch of other crises, but there really hasn't been, I think, anything quite like what we're seeing now for a very long time. But there's some important principles, one of which is you need to have an organized approach to responding. And another important principle is that communications in a crisis when people are uncertain and fearful is part of the response. It's not just telling people about the response, but your ability to communicate is absolutely core to your success in managing a crisis. And a third major principle is that politics can sometimes interfere with crisis response. And pretty much every crisis, there's some political story that goes with it. All of those three things are really in evidence now. We have had a reasonably uncoordinated response at the federal level. You see governors going in different directions. You see mayors struggling to make sense of it in some cases because they're getting different directions from different people and conflicting signals from their own population as people are then responding to different communication messages. There has not been a very clear communication message or a set of communicators that are credible who really understand how to manage a very difficult situation. You know, one of the things about communication in a crisis like this is that when the facts are always changing, and the recommendations are kind of always changing, you need people who can be trusted, people who will be able to change their mind and explain why and not lose everyone and not feel like they're flip-flopping. And I think, you know, we're lacking that a little bit at the moment. And so there's, you know, a whole range of different challenges. The third one I mentioned was politics. And, you know, this has become, unfortunately, a bit of a political football with, people making allegations that the public health response to this is about ulterior agenda other than trying to keep people safe. And I think that, you know, undermines the credibility of the response and makes it more difficult for people to realize what they need to do to protect themselves and their communities.
Talk to me about, you said this is, you didn't write about the Spanish flu 1918, 1920, around that area of time, but you've studied, I'm sure, far more than I have, the 57 flu, MERS, SARS, the swine flu. Why is this so different, or even polio? Why is this so different than all of those?
Well, this is in our kind of modern era, the first time we've had really a true, serious, lethal pandemic. And it is capable of killing millions of people. And so it then becomes a fight to stop that from happening that really consumes the whole world. It is really just the scale. I mean, and if you think about some of those things like SARS and MERS, very lethal, but not that contagious, or at least when you can intervene, it's much easier to intervene to prevent the contagion. H1N1, pretty contagious, spread through the world, but actually not all that dangerous. this virus is very insidious because it's certainly as or more contagious, probably more than H1N1, but then it's way more lethal than H1N1, you know, easily tenfold more lethal. And so even though it's not as lethal as SARS or MERS because the entire population is susceptible, it creates this massive risk. And you see in Italy and now in New York, the risk is that you get so many people sick that it sinks the healthcare system and it puts so many people's lives at risk, including healthcare workers.
Right, and you see a lot of that where healthcare workers seem to be overwhelmed in some spots with the virus, and thus their immune system sort of break down and they sort of catch it, at least in other countries in droves, and this country starting to and quite.
I talked to a friend of mine today who said she has two friends who are physicians in their 40s now on ventilators in New York City.
Right, and that is just extremely scary. And what about the students in your class? This must make for the most interesting discussion that you've ever had in class.
Well, you know, we started the class, we were talking a little bit about, you know, the new virus in China. By the end, the last class was remote because we couldn't meet at the school because they canceled all the in-person classes. We actually invited a Washington Post reporter to sit in on the last class and they wrote a story about it where we were sort of going over with the students, you know, how the response had gone, and they were coming up with different ideas they had for how it could have gone better.
When you look at leadership, and again, just indulge me if you will, don't if you're not comfortable doing so, you look at sort of the leadership of President Trump, Governor Cuomo, Governor Newsom, Governor Pritzker, Governor DeWine in Ohio has been sort of out in front with a little bit of leadership on this. You see different leadership responses. Any thoughts or commentary on any of that? And just speak to what you're comfortable with. You know.
Sure. I mean, I pay a lot of attention to the public health side of the leadership. You know, I think it's important in a public health crisis for there to be real public health leadership, because I think people, if you've been following how much people care about what Dr. Fauci says, Dr. Anthony Fauci, and they hang on his every word because they believe him. They see him as credible. He is credible. And people who are vacillating in their positions, like the president does sometimes, or just a polarizing figure, it's just much harder to have that true, you know, trust in from a scientific perspective. They're not scientists. And so I think that there's sort of the executive leadership side, and then you see different styles, and I'm probably not qualified to comment on them exactly. But I personally like to see executive leaders have an approach that respects the expertise of public health leaders and is able to draw on that and basically stay at arm's length from some of the decision making because they understand that things are going to change, and they're relying on a evidence-based and technical response. It's sort of like, you know, in the Gulf War, it was the generals giving the briefing. It wasn't the president pretending to be the generals. And I think in general, it's better for the public health voice to be heard. You know, can I just tell you one story from history, which you may or may not
Please.
Remember, the 1976 swine flu, when President Ford made an announcement to the whole population that every man, woman, and child, those were his words, would get vaccinated. It was February or March, and he was saying in the fall, we would have a vaccine to protect the country from a pandemic. And he announced it, and all the scientists and the public health people were like, well, I guess that's our job. And so they went along, they made the vaccine. In the meantime, that swine flu that had killed someone in February never returned to planet Earth. It never caused any other diseases. And so the summer's coming, the fall's coming. There's no flu anywhere on Earth. It's gone. And there were a lot of people who thought it was a bad idea to vaccinate everyone against a virus that didn't really exist. And they went ahead and did it because the president had committed them to. And one of the analyses of what went wrong, you know, people got harmed, they had to pull the vaccine, it was enormously embarrassing. President lost his election, may or may not have been related. And one of the findings of the reviews afterwards was that, you know, when the president sets a policy and just gets up and makes a policy, then everybody else kind of can't, you know, say I don't think that's such a good idea. On the other hand, and it's very hard to change. On the other hand, if you have a good public health leader, they'll explain a policy and then they can change and explain why they're changing.
Got it. And yes, that ability to sort of say, like, this is a moving set of facts, but you want somebody very evidence-based, very smart, very schooled in that area to be able to say this is changing, and we might have to change our approach with it, but at least we're starting with an understanding of what this is. When you look at this virus, and any sense yet of being able to predict outcomes on this, and do you have any sense of that or not, or don't want to guesstimate on where this, what the outcome becomes?
I can't guess where this is going to be coming, where this is going to wind up. What I've been telling people is we will know a lot more in 1 to 2 months. We'll know whether we have been able to weather the storm in New York, whether we've been able to bend the curve in other areas, flatten the curve. We'll know, a little bit more about its virulence in the United States. We'll know whether some of these treatments that are being rapidly studied work. We're going to know a lot more. And based on that, we'll be able to be a little bit more thoughtful and hopefully a little bit more targeted in some of the recommendations that we take. But I think people who are sure what's going to happen now aren't really to be relied on.
Right. At the end of the day, we'll know more. Every week, every month, we know more. We have a better sense of what's really going to happen and how it's going to play out here. Different question for you. Johns Hopkins, always internationally renowned, university, health system, and more, it's become the resource that everybody goes to check facts and stats on this epidemic, pandemic. How did that happen? And are you proud of the institution for putting itself in that position?
I definitely am proud. I think it started because there was a great engineering faculty member, Lauren Gardner, who put together a map that now gets 10 million hits a day for people to see the spread of the coronavirus. But it's also because we have a Center for Health Security that is devoted to health security issues like pandemic planning 24/7, even before this happened. Actually, last fall, they did a simulation of a new coronavirus emerging out of China 2 months before it did emerge out of China. So they've been thinking about this for a while and have been responsible for some of the things that the government has put into place directly and indirectly to be helpful here. But they've also been ringing the alarm about the lack of preparedness, not only in the United States, but around the world. And then they're just, you know, we have 600 public health faculty with an amazing medical school and hospital system. So that every aspect of the virus and its effect on people has been the focus of somebody's work, even just in the last couple months. You know, I started my own podcast called Public Health on Call, not my own podcast, the school's podcast. Called Public Health on Call, and we interview people from all around Johns Hopkins and outside of Johns Hopkins, but 10 to 15 minutes talking to them about their perspective. So we've talked to a virologist, we've talked to a historian, we talked to an epidemiologist, a modeler, and we get all these different perspectives on what's happening.
Fascinating. And so another question, there's so much politically made of, did this originate in China? Did it not originate in China? Should it be called the Wuhan virus, which seems to become so politicized, versus COVID-19, versus the coronavirus? Why do some of these emerge from wet markets, things like that? How does that happen? Does it disproportionately happen? Is that ridiculous to say that? And what should we call this? Do we call this coronavirus, COVID-19? What do you call it?
We used to call it the novel coronavirus. There's a more technical term for it, but I refer to it as the novel coronavirus. And then the disease is called COVID-19 that it causes. And it most certainly did arise in Wuhan. And, when people looked at the genetic code, it looks very much like it jumped species. And it wouldn't be the first time that that's happened. I mean, basically, there's constant interchange between species, but generally, you know, this doesn't happen. But every so often, you lose the lottery, and we really lost the lottery this time.
Got it. And let's hope it's not that bad a loss of the lottery, at least no worse than it's already looking like it could be. Certainly, the deaths in Italy have far surpassed, now we're surpassing the ones in China. I mean, hopefully those deaths have started to peak. Is this the kind of thing where the deaths in Italy versus deaths in China, we just don't really know because we don't really have good stats on it. Because, you know, or is it something like we just weren't really told how many deaths there really were in China? Any thoughts along those lines, Dr. Sharfstein? And again, don't answer if uncomfortable, but, you know, trying to understand, this got so bad so quickly in other places. China did a very good job of quickly closing down a couple of huge areas, and perhaps they wouldn't have done that unless they recognized how bad this was. What's your sense of this? Is the current intelligence on this still just so evolving that we really don't know what the real story was in China, but we could see it up front and personal and closely in the Western countries and in Europe? Or what's your sense of that?
I don't think I'm really qualified to answer that. I mean, I think what was said about what was going on in Wuhan was pretty horrible. I mean, there were a lot of deaths. There were you know, massive quarantines. I don't think you could look at what was going on in China and go, this is a minor thing. They're saying it's a minor thing. I mean, there was a full mobilization. They were saying this was basically war. So, you know, that should have been a total wake-up call to other countries at that point, I think.
That you got to view it as a total war and you got to get prepared for it fully. Fascinating. So I guess as I hear you talk, Dr. Fauci, public health leaders up in front is the best way to go about it. You mentioned the three aspects of managing this kind of thing, political communication. Would you just go through that again very quickly, and I'll let you go?
Sure. You know, that you need a coordinated, clear management structure, very good communication, because that's part of the response, and you need to be able to weather the politics to get the right thing done. And, you know, those are the key things. I think we haven't quite been there yet in the United States on those, but, you know, it a lot rides on us doing better.
Thank you so much, Dr. Sharfstein. Just a great pleasure. I am so thrilled and honored to have you join us today. Pleasure for us to talk to somebody who's so intelligent on these issues and so clear speaking and thinking on them. So thank you very, very much, Dr. Sharfstein.
Okay, take care.